Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and we are back. Well, kind of. This is kind of a post-holiday, get-the-caught-up show. Sadly, Jeff just texted us not too long ago. Something came up, unavoidable. He had to go help some family. And so he'll be back, not next week, because he'll be out doing some family stuff too. But on next week's episode, Dennis and I will be interviewing another author, Mr. Robert B. O'Connor, who wrote The Jeep Show. And as you see, it says a novel. And this is, pun intended, kind of a nice novel idea. We here in the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, we love biographies. We love nonfiction. We love autobiographies. Yeah. For we sure. are up to our elbows in biographies.
For sure.
And in the past, we've had conversations when it comes to video games, movies, historical fiction, if you will. You know, we rag on video games a lot, but we also bring up the fact that video games are great because they introduce people to, especially younger kids, to the topic of World War II, and maybe when they're flipping through YouTube. I would say 10 years ago when they're flipping through TV channels and they come across History Channel and they see a clip of D-Day, they might stop, but everybody's unsubscribed. Kids aren't flipping through channels anymore. But maybe if something comes across, the algorithm picks up and something comes across their algorithm, they might stop it if they notice a photo that looks like the video games are playing. Then you have great movies, and which I'm going to get controversial here. Please email me, mail call at WTSPWorldWar2.com. If I offend you, the Hulu remake of Catch-22 is better than the original movie. I said it. When I first saw the original movie, it was on the side of a trailer from a projector at a World War II event. And I'm watching this movie. I'm like, everybody, whoever made this movie, they're all on coke. I mean, it was made in the 70s. I felt like it was a World War II equivalent of Pink Floyd, The Wall. I'm watching this thing. I'm like, this is a freaking coke. This is a drug film. And I understand it's based off of a novel, a fiction novel. But I find that the Hulu remake is more coherent, more cogent. And
yeah, I found it the same.
And less low budget. And I know that's hard to understand when in the original movie they actually had real airplanes. But when it came to like the gory effects, like when the swimmer gets his head cut off by the guy flying the plane over him, it looks so cheesy and so dumb. You know, you had the foam head flying off and squirt, squirt. They like completely redid that scene. The miniseries is better. But the reason I bring it up is the miniseries and Catch-22 is a bit of, it's still out there. It's completely super fiction, but I'm just bringing this up as bleeding into this book. It's fictional characters, fictional events taking place in a real timeline and things that we all know and love. So maybe step away from the biography. From what I understand, when the author was writing this book, actually what led him to write this book is he was doing research on a real life person who participated in these type of quote unquote Jeep shows, which the concept behind this is instead of you can't send a big full scale USO show to the front lines. You know, Bob Hope's going to go to the rear with the gear. The whole concept of Jeep show is you get three actors and a Jeep driver. And as they say in the book, it's a K ration equivalent of a USO show. And you're going out to the front line to try to boost morale and entertain people. We all know Mickey Rooney served in World War II. We all know he was a famous actor. And in the entrance of this book, they said, you know, we've taken some real names and some real people and the concept of them, and we fictionalized them to tell this story. And the story, it's about a Jeep show, and they travel around, and we'll get into it in depth next week. But it's fun to read a fiction-based story in real timelines after reading real stuff. And I'm interested, and we'll get into it next week, I'm interested to see your opinion, because when I'm reading this, it reads like a movie or TV show. And just give you like one little hint. Wow. I'll get into. And the cool thing is the way the author does this, it's almost like he takes all the stuff that we know about World War II, just the little things, right? And peppers it in there when developing a scene, developing a storyline, developing a character, he peppers all these little things in as almost a way to bring up non-World War II aficionados into the world and the timeline of World War II.
Oh, that's smart.
For example, when they're at boot camp, they're talking about breaking in their new M1. He didn't come out and say M1 thumb, but he talks about, you know, when shooting the M1 and getting familiar with the new rifle, you don't want to... He uses colorful words to basically describe M1 thumb. Now, we all know what M1 thumb is, and so he didn't have to say M1 thumb, but things like that. But then it's kind of like a comedy aspect. So he's painting the picture. The character's having this back and forth. Because once again, this is about a traveling comedy group in a Jeep called, you know, they're broken up in different groups called Jeep shows. But at boot camp, the way he writes it, it's almost like you're watching Catch 22 type show. More serious. It's not far out there, but just follow me along here. So he's painting a picture of going through boot camp, and he talks about next door is the grenade training. And so him and this guy's talking kind of like the A line and the B line, the guy's training the new private to throw grenades. And it gets to the point where the grenades detonate and no longer makes you jump on the gun range. And so they're having this conversation. He said, and then passes as the ambulance drives by, because in this comedy storyline, the guy at the grenade range fucked up when someone got hurt. And so as they're explaining, all of a sudden, as the sound of an ambulance driving by. And so it's kind of like that airplane-ish Catch 22, but more serious. It reads kind of like a comedy or almost a TV series. And it's a good read. It's a fun read. And the concept behind this is great. We're going to talk to Robert next week, and he'll bring up the speed on this, because I'm interested to learn more about the true side of Jeep shows and those type of activities and how much of it he took artistic licensing with. Obviously, the characters and the storyline, but the concept of how this was to work and the reasoning behind it. But it's a great read. So if you guys love World War II, as you do, because you listen to this podcast, but maybe you want to step away from a novel for a book. You know, we've been reading a biography. I'm sorry, reading biographies and autobiographies every other book. And you want to step into some historical fiction, but with a lot of truth and a great writing. Definitely tune in next week to learn out how you can get a copy of The Jeep Show by Robert B. O'Connor. So we're looking forward to that. Thanksgiving just came and passed. How was your Thanksgiving, fella?
It was awesome. Yeah, it was awesome. We met up with some family and did something different this time around. Usually it's just a bunch of eating and conversating, but this time around we tried after the food and whatnot. We got some games out. Taboo, which I remember playing a lot in college, which was a blast. And then we played Gestures, and man, everybody just got into it. It was awesome. It was awesome. Went on for hours. I think we were up to like 1, something like that in the morning. Just everybody having a great time. It was really cool. Today, when I was working at the ranch today, I was listening to Megyn Kelly interviewing RFK Jr. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about how important the weekends were for their family and the Kennedy extended family, and that they would always outside and they'd be kicked outdoors and they had to come up with ways to entertain themselves, and how important that was to be outside and doing things and as a family and the tight knit. And I got to experience that, you know, this past Thanksgiving, which sometimes in the past has been kind of formal and slam bam and everybody goes and they're full, but it was neat. It was neat to do it this way.
For our Thanksgiving, we do what we do every year. We go to Carrie's sister-in-law's house, big Cuban family. So, you know, I think all together with me, Carrie, my daughter, and then my father couldn't go. I think all in all, there's 23 of us. 2 deep fried turkeys and an oven roasted turkey.
Wow.
This guy had to carve 3 turkeys. That's a lot of carving.
Electric?
No. Next year, I'm taking some cutlery with me. I forget. It's the 3rd year in a row I've had to carve turkeys. And out of all the stuff they have, sharp knives is not one of them. But I was able to make do. Put a little hint out for you future fathers, you future husbands. Maybe you're growing up and your grandfather and your dad always carved the turkey and you're wondering, you know, shit, I'm getting married next year, you know, or I'm looking at getting married, or perhaps you just got married and your wife's already talking about next year, you know, we're doing Thanksgiving in our house. You're like, well, who's going to carve the turkey? Here's how I learned. I make homemade quesadillas. You get a block of cheese, some tortillas, okay, Jeff's coming on. So, hold on. So while I invite him, here's the deal. You get tortillas, a block of cheese, and then Publix, our grocery store, and a lot of grocery stores do it, sell rotisserie chickens.
Oh, yeah.
And so you get the knife, you clean the chicken, and you use that for your chicken on your chicken quesadilla, and it saves you the time for having to fry up chicken. And since it's rotisserie, hypothetically, it's healthier. But my point being is if you carve enough turkeys, I mean enough rotisserie chickens, a turkey is just a bigger rotisserie chicken. So it's like going from working on a miniature model to going on working on a bigger model. And so you
clean 48 enough, scale to 72.
Yeah, you clean enough you clean enough rotisserie chickens, carving three turkeys in one night with a dull knife isn't bad. But yeah, so we did that, but as you can tell by maybe the raccoon eyes, my sunny disposition, someone turned the heat off here in Florida. Right now, oh, I got my Jeep cap on. I think it's currently in Florida right now. Keep in mind, we're lizard people, and we live in hot humidity. It's currently 50 degrees, 53 degrees outside. And it got down to 40 last night. I've been sleeping with my windows open.
Oh, my goodness.
So anyhow, Thanksgiving comes around. I had to work Wednesday because we're moving our offices. And then Thursday's Thanksgiving, but I had Friday, Saturday, and Sunday off. With the exception of Saturday, I got up at 5:30 on Friday, Sunday, and even Thursday before Thanksgiving. And I went out on my kayak. I think I spent 15 hours kayak fishing over the last 4 days. And to your point, I've lived in Florida for 20 years. I just started fishing within the last four. I have spent more time outside off of my phone, with the exception of when I'm taking photos or if I'm live streaming, out in nature, fishing, on my kayak, obviously the World War II events. I spend so much time outdoors. And A, sunlight's good for you. The oxygen's good for you.
Yeah, for sure.
The sounds, the sights, seeing things are good for you. I did some saltwater fishing on Sunday, saw four manatee.
Oh, that's so cool.
Caught three snook on my kayak, a redfish. My buddy caught a 2.5-pound snook. We were cleaning it up, but just being outside, outdoors, away from air conditioning, away from YouTube, away from everything, it is so good for you.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we've talked about in the past. Sorry, just letting Jeff know. One of the nice things about if you're able to do an overnight, a week long living history event, and you have the equipment or the means or the body to sleep on the ground underneath the wool blankets for the weekend, just, or during the day, just sitting on the ground, just something about that physical contact with the earth, sleeping in the trees, breathing the fresh air, getting drunk, passing out at 2 a.m. and then still waking up at 6 a.m. It recharges you. It does something for you. And other than the history, one of mine, and I know a lot of our living historians, our favorite part of events after the crowd goes away and it's just the park closes or the location closes, and from 5 o'clock at p.m. until 5 a.m. the next day, you got nothing to do. And it's kind of like you're talking about, going back to the, I'm gonna say olden days, but basically 1996 when I was in high school, we'd go camping on the weekends, but just a bunch of dudes sitting around a fire talking, not using their cell phones, communicating, hanging around a campfire and just having a hell of a time. And that's, you know, one very nice thing about reenacting, or just you work on a ranch, or me on my kayak for 18 hours in the last 4 days. Get outside, people.
Yeah, for sure.
We need it. We're not getting outside enough.
Yeah.
What's going on, Jeff?
Hey, guys.
Hey, man.
I like your ensemble there. Is that a Barnes shirt? Looks like Barnes.
Yeah.
Or is that Elias or Barnes? Who wore the cutoff sleeves? I think Elias did. Remember they're in the hooch and they're all smoking? I think he had the cutoff sleeves when he had the bandana around his
head. Yeah. This is my everyday shirt. It's Army issue 1950s, just the green dungaree, but
with that stash, I thought of
and the
hat. People.
Yeah, I thought more like the Blue Oyster from Police Academy.
Do I need to leave? Golly.
We just started. Speaking of caps, I don't know if you can see the Jeep cap I'm wearing. I don't know how I find myself in these cool situations. This is a first run from Czechoslovakia of a guy I came across Facebook, and this has defects on it, which is why it's a first run. But he's trying to make a more authentic Jeep cap. For example, here's the one we all know and love. You know, looks like a modern-day sock hat, kind of fat, kind of poofy. This is one I got from one of the, obviously not World War II impressions right at the front, but somewhere else. And this is the one he's making. And he noticed when he got it that the color's a little off, but he's using a little bit different knit. So it doesn't look so much like a 1980s sock hat, you know what I mean? You can see the difference in puffiness. And so he's fine-tuning them. He's going to use a little bit thicker knit, but he's trying to actually make a more authentic Jeep cap. And so since these are a little bit defective first runs, I picked one up just for the hell of it. But biggest difference I notice, it doesn't have the itch that these have. These kind of give you that sock hat itch on the scalp. This one doesn't. Plus, being in Florida, it's thinner. On those mornings where it's super chilly out, like with 53 now, and maybe you wear it a little long, it doesn't get so hot. So, yeah, I'm interested to see how run number 3 looks. I mean, this is run 1, and the color's a little bit off. You know, when you're reproducing or coming up with a new design and you're a new company, you got to find new vendors and all that stuff. So he's going through that section right now and trying to sort this out so that
that's cool though.
Maybe we can have a more authentic, less expensive, I think including the international shipping from Czechoslovakia probably paid the same as I did for the well-established one that's out there. But yeah, so it's nice and cold here. And Jeff, before you came in, we were just discussing our Thanksgiving Day fares and what we did. How was your family over Thanksgiving?
Well, it's hard to complain. It was not a normal Thanksgiving for us, just barring the issues that my dad's had, but it was nice. I was back in the classroom today. It was a professional development day, no students. Good time to plan, and it just reminded me how quickly the time goes, man. And especially when you're a teacher, when everything's kind of blocked, like we kind of operate in like 3-week planning periods, right? Every 3 weeks, it's a progress report or a report card. And my gosh, there's 3 weeks left and we're done for Christmas.
So you do 6-week semesters?
Yeah. 6-week marking periods there. So it goes so fast. And, for me, it doesn't seem that long ago that we said goodbye to Logan when he went off to Army basic training. And but he graduates. Well, I talked to him, over the break a little bit. And we talked to him on Thanksgiving, which was really nice. Wasn't expecting that. We typically he'd have about 30 minutes or so on a Sunday if he got a pass. But hearing him talking to him on Thanksgiving was really special because the day before he had earned his crosssabers. Wow. And he's officially a Cav trooper.
Man.
And, I told him, I said, Logan, they put some cool stuff on my uniform, but nothing topped the feeling of getting crosssabers. And I was a little curious how they were going to do it, right? It's the new military. Everything's soft and squishy and Velcro and high speed.
No more punching it into the skin. Is that what you're getting to?
That's what I thought, but I'm finding more and more as I talk to him and I hear what these drill sergeants are executing there at Fort Moore, not a whole lot has changed. So as opposed to it being punched into you, it was slammed into his hand. So it's still the collar brass with the pin back without the damage on it. it goes into the palm of his hand, and the drill sergeants come by and shake your hand and squeeze it in. So it's just kind of sitting flush in his palm. And but what really, really made me feel good was he said, Daddy said, the senior drill came up to me. And he said he didn't shake anybody else's hand. Everybody out there in bandit troop. And he said he came up to him, and he said he put his brown round right there in the bridge of Logan's nose, pulled him in, squeezing those sabers in one last time. And he said, you are one of the few that deserves these sabers. So go on and do big things.
Whoa.
And that was really, yeah, to really hear that. I mean, you know, there wow. guys got recycled. That's still a thing. But I get it. It's today's military. It's a citizen army, and you still got to keep those numbers up, push them off to a scout platoon, let the cadre there, you know, drill them and get them trained up. Drill sergeant's job today is not to select the 10%, you know, it's more looking like you want to graduate the 90%. So it's fine. But you know, Logan earned everything that the Army gave him, and he's going to continue to do good things. We found out he will be at Fort Riley, Kansas, which is a really, really cool, you know, pre-Civil War post. And he's going to Quarter Cav, 1st Battalion, 4th Cav Regiment, 1st Infantry Division, Big Red 1. So lots wow. of really cool World War II ties there. I mean, even yeah. World War I and Vietnam. So he's pumped, and he may be cycling to Korea possibly as early as February for his first deployment rotation. Wow. So he's going to hit the ground running, and it's really something special to see for sure.
Congratulations to you. You got to be super proud.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to be happy to get him back next week, so that's why I'll be out of pocket. But, yeah. Good stuff going on.
Dude, hell man, yeah. I'm so proud. Dude.
Now, doing this completely blind, not getting any details, no names or nothing. Dennis, I know you were working on something that could turn out to be very cool. A few weeks ago, you had a meeting with someone. How did that kind of go? Good?
Yeah.
In the middle? Still working?
Yeah. It went very, very well.
Cool. What is up, everybody? On behalf of everyone here at Digital 410 Media, I just want to say happy Thanksgiving. And we're doing it again. We're doing a back-to-back Patreon giveaway. So if you have yet to decide to sign up for Patreon, please head over to patreon.com/D410. Sign up for the December member prize giveaway. This month, we are thrilled to feature the beautiful exclusive print from Military Aerospace Art, showcasing the incredible bravery of First Lieutenant Huey Lamb Jr. The stunning piece captures a historic mission on March 19, 1945, with Lieutenant Lamb piloting his P-51 Mustang, the Etta Jean II. Intercepting and destroying a low-flying Ardo 234 jet. Don't miss your chance to own the slice of World War II aviation history that is autographed by Huey Lamb Jr. Thank you guys so much for your continued support through 2024. We're looking forward to 2025. Happy Thanksgiving, and we love you all.
Yeah, I went met somebody in regards to one of the books I've been working on, and when I went to drive up there to meet him, I stopped at a cemetery on the way, something I'll do from time to time, and just plugged in my earbuds and put on my grandpa's favorite World War II song, Stardust. And this particular version was Tommy Dorsey's band. And it was a big deal, which I'll be able to talk about more freely in the future. But you know, walking among the tombstones there and just listening to the voices and trying to get some inspiration and collecting my thoughts, and then I walked in and knocked it out of the park.
Beautiful.
And it was really, really awesome. And
speaking of your book, because the holidays are upon us and people are probably maybe trying to think of what they should get somebody for Christmas, and maybe they have a like-minded person in their lives, and we know they can get your current book, the one that just came out, via the link on our website, WTSPWorldWar2.com. But I think we mentioned in the past, if someone's interested in perhaps communicating you directly to maybe get an autographed version, which obviously they can't do on Amazon. How can people reach you to acquire? Should I just have an email at info?
Yeah,
at
I'm on Facebook. Folks can friend request me on Facebook, Dennis Blocker. And also, you can email me at blockerbooks. And the last letter is a Z, blockerbooks@gmail.com.
And promote your book a little bit.
Yeah, and then we'll liaison through that. Yeah, I would, you know, gladly do that. You know, I was thinking about what would folks want to learn, or why would people want to try a new book, you know, a new author? And it's like, well, that's the whole point, you know. Give me a chance, you know, try me out for this Bonsai Cliff, Desperation's Edge, the first of my short story series. I've got really great reviews, and it's really touching a lot of people's hearts. And I got a copy off to Dan King today. He messaged me back. I told him, I gave him tracking number on it and everything, and nice. He was super excited. I sent him a signed copy, and I'm really curious what he's going to think, because he's actually, you know, interviewed Japanese veterans who fought at Saipan. And anyway. Yeah, go to I have also my website. You can go to blockerbooks.com. And that, in that case, it's, you know, blockerbooks.com.
Now, Jeff, I don't know if you have it handy, and we've been threatening to take people down to Jeff Copsetta's model corner. I don't know if maybe tonight's a little bit of a good night to kind of dip our toe into that corner. Do you have that tank that you made by? Is your camera frozen? Are you? Oh, there you are. Do you have that tank handy? So Jeff has been tripling down on his modeling work, and he's gone past the point of just following the directions and gluing them together and slapping on the labels. He's now like doing the weathering and the battle scars and the detailed painting. And we'll include photos on their website for this episode for those of you who, you know, because, well, so we need the photos. Give us a breakdown on what that is, and the whole process. You have a true passion for putting together models.
Yeah, I do. It's it goes back several generations. I actually have an aircraft on my roll top desk there that my grandfather built, you know, balsa and doped linen. So before the days of plastic kits, and he had several, you know, I remember in his house. And you know, it was very different then to put together a balsa wood, you know, model airplane. And he would blueprint his own. You know, they didn't make just every airplane imaginable, right? So he had a lot of books that would, you know, have diagrams of certain, you know, Great War, you know, biplanes and triplanes. And they would have drawings to scale, and then he would create, you know, his drawings from there to build the model. And then that course carried on to my dad, and he did more model railroading, I think, than he built some airplanes as a kid, but that's just something I never really grew out of. When I first got my first model, I was kind of hooked, and I was kind of inherently good at it, I guess. Maybe it just runs in the genes, I don't know, but it's definitely something that takes talent, right? Like, and it can be learned, of course, but I just kind of had this inherent talent, I guess. So from an early age, I was building, you know, pretty decent models. And I'm pretty unorthodox. You know, when you look at the scale modeling world today, it's, my gosh, it's almost no fair, right? With 3D printing and
yeah, for sure,
LEDs and fiber optics and all this stuff. I mean, I look at my stuff and go, wow, that's pretty amateur with what some of these guys do today. I build mine straight out of the box for the most part. You know, I mean, yeah, I custom make different things here and there if it calls for it. I get some photo etched brass seat belts, but other than that, it's just my talent. For people who do model, I don't airbrush. And I think that's another thing that, you know, how could you do a model without airbrushing in today's world? And I'm pretty, you know, economy minded, and I like to use the some of the common things you got around the house, you know, to create different ways to weather. And I've just kind of found my little niche. So
yeah, because when you sent me photos of that tank, and what model Sherman is that? Is that the A1 or is that like the A?
It's an A1. Yeah, it's an A1.
I used to know how to tell via the vertical suspensions or the horizontal. I know they changed the suspension between certain models, but it's been so long since I've delved into tank stuff that I can remember which ones were what.
Yeah, they were commonly referred to as the Easy Eights. The E8 late war with the horizontal suspension, you see that in Fury, but very very late war there. But I don't know, I wanted to do something that had to do with the Battle of the Bulge, and after Dennis and I got to hang out with Helen Patton for a night, it kind of re-energized, you know, my interest in the Bulge. And I don't do a lot of armor. You know, I do a lot of more aircraft than anything else. So this is only the second Sherman I've done. I wanted to do kind of the whiteout, you know, December, January 44 paint scheme. And I just picked one that there's some pictures that exist. This one was called Ferocious and Ferocious 3. And, you know, like it still exists today. If you're in F company, you're going to name your tank with a word that begins with an F. Or if it's C company, they're all going to begin with a C. So this one's from F company of the, I believe it's the 33rd Regiment, 3rd AD, 3rd Armored Division. So, yeah, just a little tribute. And I ordered the... the crew is separate, you know, that doesn't come with the model. And
upgrade.
I totally like experimented with how to do the mud, and I think it came out really well. It's a three-dimensional type spray paint. I forget what it was called, but it's something for like painting pots outside. It's a Rust-Oleum. You buy it at the hardware store, and I saw that, and I was like, oh. That might work out pretty well. I practiced with it for a little bit on something else. I was like, yep, that's it.
That's awesome. It's kind of like that texture paint you use on your wall, but in an outdoor application. When it comes to someone getting into model building or desire to get into it, is something like a tank easier than a plane because you're not trying to construct a small cockpit? It has bigger, broader sides. Is there something else you would recommend, like for someone's first model experience? What's something that's cool that maybe has less small parts, like a cockpit or the interior dashboard of a Jeep? Or what's a good place, what's a good vehicle for someone to maybe dip their toe into the model world?
Well, that's a great question. Because going from armor and aircraft really is two very different things. There's people that they just do aircraft. There's people that just do armor, or they just do classic vehicles, right? I mean, they're also very different. This Sherman has a ton of parts on it. It really is. It's more complicated than it looks.
I guess all the
and I should have took some more progress pictures, but I can't remember how many photo etched brass parts there are on it that all have to be bent with tweezers. It can be tedious. One thing I don't like doing about armor is everything you do when it comes to suspension, you're doing it like 12 times or 6 times, right? When you're building all the road wheels and everything. That's not always fun. Aircraft, the big thing you have to worry about is making sure that everything is tight. The dihedral on the wings are correct and on your horizontal stabilizers. The cockpit's the fun part. I mean, yeah, it's tedious. There's a lot of neat little things that nobody's going to see once you put the airplane together.
Unless you get your fat fingers with the glue fingerprint on your cockpit window that's there forever. We've all been down that road.
God, I did that so many times.
Every kid who ever tried to build an airplane has a destroyed cockpit window with thumbprints from glue all over it.
Absolutely. That's part of the process. But, yeah, I mean, I think there's there's different levels of models. So, you know, I think 1/48th is a great. I built a lot of 1/72nd fighters as a kid. They're small. They were cheap at the time. 1/48th, you can do both ends of the spectrum. There's some 1/48th kits I've seen that are 40, 50 pieces, very basic, throw it together kind of thing, and don't spend a whole lot of time on the cockpit. You're not going to see it anyway. Throw a pilot or a rear gunner or whatever, and you're good. Others, you know, they're more in depth. You build a lot more. It's broken down a lot more, and the pieces look like really the parts of the aircraft itself. You know, it's the way it's designed. It's almost like you're building a condensed version of a real aircraft. So it can get, you know, pretty intense on something.
In your mind, is there instinctively? I want to say yes because a diorama has more to it. But however, I'm seeing some of these where people, as you reply, taking a model tank, right? And they're making it live action where they're they're melting a plastic and then embedding red LED lights and then putting, you know, plastic smoke or whatever. It's not mounted to a board yet. It's still freestanding. But it's in your mind, is there a difference between a model and a diorama?
Yes and no. I mean, every part of a diorama is essentially you're modeling something. Mm-hmm. To me, a diorama is a lot more creative. You can
more storytelling.
Build a great kit. You know, you spend the money for a really, really good kit that you don't have to worry about. You know, everything fits perfectly. I mean, they're engineered pristine. And sometimes the more expensive the model, the less talent you need because talent is having to fix the flaws.
Yeah.
But when you're modeling, and I've done several dioramas, and everything I've done is very different techniques to do Iwo Jima, to do Tarawa, and then to do, you know, a hard stand for a bomber in England.
Yeah, that was
all
cool.
Very different. Yeah, they're all very different. So, I think to me, they're both one and the same, and they complement each other. But you're right. I think a diorama sometimes it tells more of a story for people who maybe don't understand.
Dude, there are pictures the whole of your diorama story. Of your B-17 hardstand. There are pictures that you've taken of that thing that you, unless you absolutely know, you would not be able to tell if it was real or not. Like if it was an actual, like you have done some amazing work on that hardstand. I remember you had it out. I think because it was like the sunset was right.
Yeah.
Like it had the perfect orange hue. And it just, those pictures turned out so good. Yeah.
I saw, it has nothing to do with World War II.
Back there.
So good.
Every once in a while, a kind of a video or on Instagram, a photo pop up of people's dioramas. And I saw one the other day, someone recreated, and I don't know how they got the dust particles and everything. They recreated the opening jump scene from Dukes of Hazzard with the General Lee, complete with the broken bridge, dust trailing off the back. It's like the amount of technology that they're using to make it look like dust particles are flying off the back of this thing. It's insane, the effort. And like I said, you know, the battleship scenes where you're seeing, it looks like flickering lights where things are on fire. It's just, it's insane how much this stuff has changed in the last 10 years. It's like leaps and bounds.
Yeah, it really hasn't. Honestly, I think one of the changes that I don't like about the hobby is the expense.
Yeah.
You have to try to keep an economy mind because
yeah.
You go to a hobby shop now, if you can find one,
yeah.
That you know, one that eBay hasn't completely shut down.
And we're not talking about Hobby Lobby. They don't count.
No, an actual true hobby shop where the guys that work there, they can tell you, they know the paint codes that, you know, you can buy a kit and they'll walk over and say, okay, you're going to need this, and this because they know the colors. And I'll never, we had a great one here and I wanted to do an early war Corsair. And I remember having the conversation with a guy that worked there that said, okay, you got to be careful when the transition was, when the inside of the landing gear doors went from a salmon color primer to the flat white. And I thought everything was interior green. He's like, oh man, you got a lot to learn.
He could probably tell you what size exacto blade to use on what model because you got to trim it just right.
Right, but that's the experience of a hobby shop, you know. Yeah, I mean, they know
those guys on here.
they're invested in, but everything is so expensive now, and it kind of breaks my heart because a 10, 12-year-old kid ought to be able to spend, you know, 10, 15 bucks and use their creativity and build a model airplane or something. But
I know we want to keep this short, so before we wrap it up, I like this topic. Let me ask you this. Is it fair to say that a true hobby requires a lot of time, energy, and effort? And let me tell you, we have a Cricut. That's what I use to make a lot of her vinyl stickers. And Carrie bought it because she wants to do things for school, print up names. I'm sure as you see, people put names on walls and interior decoration. But her biggest complaint about the Cricut is it takes a lot of time and patience. Yeah, I'm like, well, that's why they sell it at a hobby shop. Hobbies require time and patience and skill. I mean, is that fair to say that a majority of even modern day hobbies requires time, skill, and dedication to that particular hobby? Can you half-ass a hobby? I don't think you can you?
I think the whole point of a hobby is that you enjoy it, right? If you have a hobby, you enjoy it. So you're going to spend hours doing it.
Yeah, it's something you want to do. I totally agree with that.
That's for sure.
I was probably in my 30s before I realized that my dad's model railroad was an escape from police work.
Wow.
It was his escape. And you know, that's just how it's always been for him. I mean, yeah, it's his hobby and he loves it and he hasn't been a cop in 25 years. But it's something that's therapeutic for you. And I know even my wife's like, "What? That doesn't even look like fun. Oh my gosh." Like, you got tweezers, these little tiny pieces, like, but babe, like, nobody's gonna know they're there, but I'll know they're there, you know? And you know, for me, what I do this for, it's another way for it to be a tribute to the greatest generation. That's why I want to get it right. I built certain airplanes that have certain stories of the pilots or that battle. You know, the hardstand is kind of a conglomeration. It's just a tribute to the entire Mighty Eighth because it's got a B-17, a 51, a P-47, and I even threw in an early war Spitfire because we talked about this, you know, they were fighter escort for a lot of the early 8th Air Force missions. So it's what these guys did. And I would want to, you know, I want to get it right because you don't want to, in that aspect, you don't want to do something halfway because it just doesn't do the guys justice. But, you know, I built my Humvee complete with my driver's spit bottles that were left all over the inside, right? Because that was our life. That was my truck, and everything that was in my truck is in that kit. Whether I had to custom make it or whatever, and that's what it's about. It's a living tribute to the past. You know,
that's awesome.
And on that note, that's going to wrap up this short edition of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, the post Thanksgiving edition. Real quick, as you were saying earlier, Jeff, the fun thing about doing models, I was explaining before he came on, I went over to Carrie's sister-in-law's parents' house for Thanksgiving. They're Cuban immigrants, and her father every year has a train set underneath his Christmas tree, and he changes the little city. And I was looking at this year, and he had like a little housing development, and for what he had the snow, but for the driveways, I was looking, I was like, he used pieces of shingle off the roof from the hurricane. So each driveway was a little square chunk of shingles that he had put down in the cotton to make it look like people plowed their driveways. But he used green and black shingles to create the concrete in the driveways from stuff he had available to him. We'll be back next week with the interview, long episode, full length episode with Robert B. O'Connor, author of The Jeep Show. On behalf of myself, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker, I know the year's not over yet, but doesn't mean we're not grateful for each and every one of you who has supported us through the last years. Hey, Jeff, I don't want to scare you or anything, but I was like, I posted a Thanksgiving episode that you and I did back in 2020. You've been doing this show for quite a while time now, dude. So it's been like, you've been around here almost as long as I have. So, yeah, you and I have been going at this for quite a while now, and we want to thank each and every one of y'all who tune in. So, yeah, if you missed it, I uploaded a Thanksgiving episode Jeff and I did in 2020. So, yeah, we've been – and the show, I think I started the show in 2018 or 2019. So Jeff's damn near been here since the beginning. But we want to thank you guys and for helping us and signing up at patreon.com. Go to patreon.com/D410 or go to WTSPWorldWar2.com. click on a Patreon link. And Jeff is responsible for hooking us up with the giveaway for December. Jeff, give a little brief synopsis on the giveaway before we wrap it up.
Yeah, so it's a beautiful print, and I don't know how many are left, but this one was hand-signed by the pilot. His name is Huey Lamb. He was a P-51 pilot. He is still with us. And he, I believe he's the only American pilot that has credit in shooting down two German jet-powered aircraft during the war, one in a P-47 and one in a P-51. He took down this particular scene is him in the P-51 taking down the Arado A-234, I want to say.
Yes.
Yeah, so really slick. Came to us from Military Aerospace Art. They had reached out to me through social media, and they're getting their website going, so they've got a great social media page. They're still building the website. Really excited about that, because when you visit the social media page, my gosh, the art that they have available there is incredible. I believe they're out of England. So they're very generous to give us an extra Huey Lamb signed print of him in his P-51 taking down the German Arado towards the end of the war. So really, really cool. What a cool giveaway. And it's already packaged up, ready to go, ship out to somebody.
It's just ready to slap your label on it. And all you have to do to be eligible to win is be an active subscriber on the day of the giveaway. We're going to probably do it. You know, maybe it's probably going to be you're going to get in your possession Christmas adjacent, because we want to give many people time to sign up as they can. But head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com, click on a Patreon link, or if you're already on Patreon, just search for D410 Media. And here's Jeff's example. Jeff has one in his library. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work, and it'll look great on your wall.
So cool.
Do yourself a favor if you win this fantastic print. Get it framed behind some nice glass so it doesn't fade over the years. See that? Jeff has it in his possession, ready to ship to you. On the behalf of myself, Mr. Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker Jr., we will talk to you all next week.
This has been a Digital 410 production.